Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on July 31st, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Upada Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha emphasizes a common theme that is present throughout his Dhamma. When the context and purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma is understood, it can clearly be seen that who and what one associates with will determine their life's experience. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So the Upada Sutta. This sutta reflects a common underlying theme throughout the Buddha's teachings on to be mindful of who and what we associate with, because who and what we associate with will determine our life experience. And that teaching isn't meant to be an isolationist kind of teaching. In other words, oh, the world is bad, we should stay away from it. It simply means that who and what we're going to engage in the most important of life's endeavors, to be mindful of who we're associating with in those endeavors, or what we're associating with in those endeavors. And then specifically, if we're hoping to develop the Dhamma, to choose those associations wisely, meaning that the people that that we're associating with in that quest for understanding are of like minds, and they're also rooted in something that is useful and effective. So the common problem of today was just as common in the Buddhist time, is how do we determine that? And this is a teaching on how to know what an admirable friend, an admirable comrade, admirable companionship is in relation to the Dhamma. So it's a great sutta. It's kind of been on the back burner for a while, and today's your lucky day. You get to hear it. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying in Saqqara. Ananda approached the Buddha, bowed, and sat to one side. He said to his teacher, "Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, and admirable camaraderie. This is half of a Dhamma practitioner's life." Ananda was thinking he was being pretty cool with that statement, like he really knew something. The Buddha responded, "Don't say that, Ananda. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, and admirable camaraderie is the whole of a Dhamma practitioner's life." It's an interesting line because it could easily be misunderstood as saying that, well, all we have to do is hang around people that are involved in Buddhist practice and we're good to go. But the rest of the sutta and the rest of the Buddhist teachings explain very clearly that being part of a sangha that is well-focused and well-informed is the whole of the life. In other words, that the sangha itself is the essence, or it's holding the three jewels, the triple refuge within that sangha. The Buddha as a teacher who understands, his Dhamma is represented in that Sangha, and the Sangha is actually developing that Dhamma. The Buddha continues, "When one has admirable friends, admirable companions, and admirable comrades, they can be expected to engage with and fully develop the Eightfold Path. And how does one who has admirable friends, admirable companions, and admirable comrades engage with and fully develop the Noble Eightfold Path? A follower of my Dhamma develops right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right meditation." So the purpose of a Sangha to be supportive of each other is to develop the Eightfold Path and to support each other in doing that. The development of this Eightfold Path is dependent on seclusion, dependent on dispassion, dependent on cessation, resulting in relinquishment from clinging to wrong views that are ignorant of Four Noble Truths. Again, it's just a definition of the purpose of a well-informed Sangha. This is how a follower of my Dhamma, who has admirable friends, admirable companions, and admirable comrades, engages with and fully develops the Eightfold Path. When understood in this context, One may know how associating with admirable friends, admirable companions, and admirable comrades is the whole of a life well integrated with the Eightfold Path. So think about that. Why is that? Why is the Buddha making that distinction, that associating with people that are developing the heartwood of the Dhamma is the whole of the life? Anybody have an answer? Because if we're associating such an important part of our life, meaning our own, and just to use the term loosely, our own spiritual development, or the development of our understanding of the true nature of life, certainly it's going to be who we associate with as part of that framework that will determine the success or the failure of it. Is that pretty clear? Not pretty clear. Is it clear? We can't associate with people that whose main focus is bowling 300 on Thursday nights. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? With being part of a bowling league. But we can't expect to be part of a bowling league to bring us understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma. If we're going to develop the Buddha's Dhamma, we associate with people that are engaged in that, and that defines them as admirable companions in the Dhamma. It is in dependence on me that this is a really wonderful line, how the Buddha holds himself out this way. It is in dependence on me, your teacher, as an admirable friend, that those subject to confused and deluded thinking and ongoing disappointment, meaning subject to dukkha, gain release from all manner of suffering arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So he's using himself as an example to define what an admirable friend is. It's someone who knows the Dhamma and can teach you the Dhamma. Again, this is in the context of the Dhamma. We're not talking about in life in general that in order for you to have an admirable friend, they have to teach you the Dhamma. In the framework of developing understanding, the most admirable friend we can have is a friend who understands the Dhamma. And so that leads to our own responsibility in the Dhamma. If we're really hoping to be Kalyanamitas to each other, true friends in the Dhamma, we have to develop the Dhamma and speak to the Dhamma. One of the rules that the Buddha established very early in the Sangha, there was many more to follow, but one of the first rules was when we're gathered as a Sangha, we speak only about the Dhamma. In other words, we don't get into debate or political discourse or talking about the chariot races or the weather or anything else. When we're gathered as a Sangha, we talk about the Dhamma. And we do that pretty well here, don't we? I mean, it's really remarkable to me. I've been part of a lot of different centers. And the focus of this Sangha on just what the Buddha taught really is remarkable. And I think it's one of the reasons why we are all developing the Dhamma in such a remarkable way. It's really working, isn't it? It's because
it's
of the...
Also because you've kept the short rein on.
I'm glad you're laughing at that. Well, yes, that's true, and I'll take some credit for it. But that was something I decided a long, long time ago, right after I first started teaching. I started teaching meditation, most of you know the story, almost as, not as a lark, but to raise money for a specific charity that Tamara Barisha, the former owner of Frenchtown Acupuncture, was involved in. And she asked me one day, would you teach meditation? I said, sure. You know, so we'll... And I really didn't think too much about it. I've been meditating for a long time, like, you know, a couple of weeks. I think we were asking for a $5 donation. And I started teaching just, you know, not really any background, just let's meditate, and this is what we do when we meditate, and a few cute little things along the way. But I very quickly realized that if I'm going to continue to do this, that I need to do it in a way that is not going to lead to more confusion and suffering for other people. And that's really when I decided that I can only teach what I know came out of the Sutta Pitakas. And that had an unintended consequence. It had me look at the Dhamma in a way that I really hadn't looked at before. I was involved in it, and I had developed a pretty good framework of the Eightfold Path as a framework for my life. But now, understanding the responsibility of other people learning from me really changed everything. I couldn't be cute with it anymore, you know? And I had to know, I remember having a thought, how can I avoid introducing my own stuff to this, my own individual take on what Buddhism should be, that I noticed throughout modern Buddhism. How can I avoid it? And the only way I knew to avoid it is to teach only what I could teach from the Sutta Pitaka. Now, of course, that even that teaching, even this teaching, is influenced by my understanding of the Dhamma. But my understanding of the Dhamma only goes as far as what the Buddha taught. And in so doing, my hope is that I can be an admirable friend to anybody who wants to learn the Dhamma and pass that on and create a Sangha that is like that, that we're all admirable friends in the Dhamma. And again, what I think one of the most remarkable things is that we've achieved that here in Frenchtown. And it's, I'll take some credit for the guy sitting up here, but it's because of each and every one of you being willing to take to the Dhamma in the way that it's intended and not insist that it be something different. So in that way, you're all admirable friends. When understood in this context, one may know associating with admirable friends, admirable comrades, admirable companions, and admirable comrades is the whole of a life well integrated with the Eightfold Path. That's the end of the sutta. And notice the reference back to the Eightfold Path as the framework for being admirable in the Dhamma. It's not doing something else. It's not, pick a practice that is outside of this. Even though it might be a wholesome practice, it has nothing to do with the Dhamma. That's what an admirable Sangha is, and you are an admirable Sangha. Thank you. Any questions about the sutta before we go around the room?
Just one question.
Please.
What did Ananda think the other half was?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I guess he would think that it's Dhamma study maybe, or meditation, or all of those things as the other half. But when the Buddha's talking about admirable friends, etc., he's talking about joining with people that do all those things, the Eightfold Path. He kept coming back to that. And of course, meditation and study, etc., is all part of that. It's an interesting question for a few reasons, David. The two talks that I'm giving Saturday and next Tuesday are on very similar subjects. In fact, there's a debate whether they're the same sutta with just different words. There's some slight differences that I think they're two separate suttas. But the idea is one who dwells in the Dhamma is one who has joined with the Dhamma. Like the Buddha used that phrase, we join with suffering. Well, we also join with the Dhamma in this way. And that's part of being an admirable friend. We join with, it's not something... it's not something that we pick and choose with, like we like right view but right effort not so much, It's a complete practice.
So to be part of the Sangha and to see the three gems, in essence, that's the whole Dhamma.
Yes, yeah, it is. And it,
so
and
it can't be anything else. Everything else would just be associated with the three.
Yeah. And so in that way, it's a completely integrated practice, isn't it? And again, you can look at it from whatever view, if you want to look at it from the point of view of the Ratana Sutta of the Triple Refuge. But all of that, and maybe this is the point that I was, I've been trying to make, and I think I made it, is that a well-informed, well-focused Sangha is the only way to develop the Dhamma. It has to be. And it can't be something else. So, again, this is, if you want to learn the Dhamma and practice the Dhamma, you do it with a well-informed Sangha. That's what the Buddha's teaching Ananda. And he's also, by inference, there's always was an influence then and now to make the Dhamma something else, to be maybe more appealing. And a lot of people came in and out of the Buddha's life saying, why don't we do this, why don't we do that, because these people will be more interested in his debates, if you want to call them that, with some of the Jains that came in and out of the Buddha's life. He could certainly see it as, well, if I would change this a little bit or let go of that a little bit or not emphasize a certain point, there'd be much more people interested. And isn't that a good thing? Well, it's not, because then all he has is a bigger venue to confuse more people. Kind of what I realized, getting back to that little story, there was the little bit of pressure that was put on me was to get as many people sitting here to raise money for charity. But that wasn't enough to take license with what I knew as the Dhamma, you know. And I think we do that remarkably well here, how supportive we are of each other in the Dhamma, and just in the Dhamma, not getting into other things. Yeah, it was a great point you brought up too. So we'll start with you, David. Good to see you tonight.
I looked at the translation from Sarah.
Yeah.
And at the very end, I think he's making reference to another sutta, but he says, learn from and emulate with your Sangha members. And I thought that was really important, because that's what I've done.
Yeah.
You know, before I even joined it, I would listen, and I would hear Lorna and Ram and, you know, Mary, and you learn and you emulate. And
yep.
That's the importance of the Sangha. I'm interested to see how you're developing your online Sangha. How is that?
Boy, that's a good...
Because that's one of the first questions you asked me was what did I think about the online aspect of it? And of course, with online, you have people listening.
They learn from this Sangha. We are... Honestly, this is a true statement. You are all admirable friends to all those other people, the millions, the hundreds that join online. You know, and it really is one Sangha. They almost to a person, they'll remark, you know, Lorna said something, or Dave said, or somebody said something, and they got so much out of it. And again, that's the Sangha. That's, I'm the teacher, but you are all teaching the Dhamma to not just here in this room. You know, that's the point. You've taken the responsibility of being admirable in the Dhamma, every one of you, seriously. And that is something to be acknowledged. I mean, maybe that's why I'm teaching this tonight. I should teach it again on Saturday too, because it's another admirable song. But that's really the point. You know, I don't know where to quite go with this. There's something honorable in taking up an endeavor and being authentic to the endeavor. Now I'm not just talking about the Dhamma, whatever it might be that you choose to do. Again, it does, if you want to learn how to rebuild 64 Mustangs, you should really put your effort into learning how to do it authentically and correctly, and maybe associate with other people that are into the same thing, because you'll just do it that much better, won't you? Rather than being part of a VW club at the same time, you know, you might want to put your... So we do that remarkably well, you know, and there's something honorable about that, I think. You know, whether anybody else, and it's not for recognition, although the sutta that I'm going to teach on Saturday talks about recognizing people that really dwell in the Dhamma or are one with the Dhamma. But there's something honorable about this, isn't it? And it changes our lives in a really meaningful way. We become better human beings by taking up the Dhamma, don't we? And every one of us knows it. Ahepasika, come and see for yourself. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
John? I should kind of take my breath away of what you just said about the online students and things. It's often I don't think about that. I just think about the people in the room, the staff members in the room, and it is make you think when other people from any other country could possibly tune into this and begin to understand. Let's hope so, anyway. I think there's a little room associating with non-Dharma members too, because I think you see your own practice sometimes in the reflection of something that's rather startling outside of Dharma people, Dharma practice. And you can sometimes see your own development that way. And you can reflect back on situations maybe that you're not getting caught up in where you would have done in the past. You see the progress that you've made. And I think that's kind of, that happens more outside the saga in real life,
yeah,
that way. So I think there's a, I'm more with Ananda, I think that's probably what Isla 50% was. and then I haven't been attending, been away, but the last time I was here was a Saturday, and I was fortunate that I stayed behind after class on Saturday for the Qigong class, and I was talking to Matt, and we were just on the back chairs there chatting, waiting for the time to pass, and of course talking about the saga and the Dharma, and I think I was kind of more talking to Matt than he was about my practice more than vice versa. But anyway, I was just sort of, we were just sort of airing the breeze, and I remember saying to Matt that I find it really the most difficult is to start segregating my body away from myself, that my body is not me, you know. And accepting my body is just the body that I'm in. It's not my body, it's just the body I'm in. And it's been so hard for me. However, as I say, I was away and at a friend's house, the lakeside, and she has a lovely little dock on the lake, her own personal property. And so I took my cushion and everything away with me, and decided to meditate on the dock one evening. And it was just at that time of the evening when the air was like warm from the day, but then there's just a time in the evening it just sort of blows a bit stronger and it's just a bit cooler, and you just get that feeling that you know, the evening sort of setting in, it's getting a bit chilly. And this happened when I was sitting out in the dock on my cushion meditating. I realized that the air was just turning that little bit cooler. But I felt that the air was around my body and that it didn't bother me. It was just swirling around my body. And I was all right. It didn't bother me. What I'm trying to say is, like, there was a disconnect or a space, you know, between my body and my skin, that I was that I could sense the air through my skin. But it didn't bother me. It was just air on my skin.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just that disconnect or space. It's hard to describe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what I didn't do is I didn't say, I am getting cold. It wasn't like that. I noticed my skin was feeling cooler. But that was just my skin getting cooler. It wasn't me.
You didn't take it personal.
I didn't take it personal, and yeah, I didn't take it personal. But there was me, whatever that is. In fact, do I make it again? I hope not. But I was okay.
Thank you. That was a great description of the. It's one of those subtly difficult things to teach. Maybe not to teach, but to get an understanding of it. The Dhamma, the Buddha, me, I hope, don't teach that there's no such thing as a body. It's that the body, along with everything else, is impermanent and always in a constant chain state of becoming. That's up to us what it's going to become. So we certainly have a body. But to overemphasize
our body through self-referential views, such as that it needs to be a certain way or act a certain way or be 25 forever or whatever it might be, that's where we get into difficulty. But the entire Dhamma is about uniting the mind in the body that we have and using that body mindfully within the framework of the Eightfold Path. So in other words, the moral and ethical aspects of the Eightfold Path require a body, don't they? For speech and action and livelihood. But that body should be used in accordance with the framework of the Eightfold Path, just like our thoughts should be used or function, or maybe flow is a better word, from that framework. And what you just described is exactly how that happens. We don't take anything personal, but we have a rather intense and visceral experience of the breeze, don't we?
Mm.
And that's a really marvelous experience to have that in that way, in a dispersal.
And I also held it throughout my sit. Sometimes you get like a flash of inspiration or whatever, or understanding in meditation, and then it kind of, you can dwell on it and think about it, and then it sort of passes. But this, I would have sat maybe 15 minutes in this state where my body was cooler and I was separate from it, and therefore just enjoying the meditation, even though my body was cooling, and I held it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
Isn't it mindfulness?
Very cool.
That's
the essence of mindfulness.
She's describing exactly what you want to experience.
Yeah.
That you can be detached and just be at that present moment.
Yep. Yeah, that's it. You know, when the cool breeze flows. Ron, good to see you tonight.
Yeah, mindful of the body as the body.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It reminds me a little bit of there's a fellow who lived around here. He wrote books under the name of The Tracker, I think. And he taught some things in Native American tradition.
I know who that is.
George Brown.
Yeah.
And his grandfather, who was a Native American, used to teach him and his buddies to run home in the middle of the winter for a mile or two in their underwear. And he said, you have to learn that the cold is not your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It's only teaching you this disconnect. Just don't take this cold personal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just cold.
Yeah.
And once you do that, you can deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. and in that way, you can deal with just about anything, and you don't need it to be any different.
Yeah. Like you have a cold.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a cold. It's there. It'll go from this stage to that stage to that stage, and then in a couple of days it'll be gone.
Yeah.
I sometimes do it with hunger. I notice that there's hunger, but as long as I can keep that disconnect, it doesn't drive me immediately to go and eat something.
Yeah. You don't get compulsive over it.
Yeah.
It's just a thought. Thank you. John Brown's Wilderness School is called. It was in Asbury, too, if I remember. This is many, many, this is 40 years ago.
He wrote a couple of books, too.
Yeah. Cool. Mike, good to see you.
Good to see you. Enjoyed the talk very much. Still getting my meditation legs back under me.
Good.
After my absence. I think I'm doing a little bit better. I'm able to focus more or be less distracted during meditation, so. That's pretty much it. I also have to cut out in about 10 minutes because I have to pick up something at the pharmacy, so don't take it personally.
I take everything personally. I'm glad you made it tonight.
Thanks.
Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here, John. I am lucky, very, very lucky to have many Sangha members in my family, and I benefited from their understanding of non-attachment and impermanence in helping me go through my house and decide what things I really need and what things I really don't need. And I'm just very grateful for that. You hold the mirror up to yourself and you see what do you really need. I still have to go through a lot more. But we made a significant dent.
Wow.
So I'm very grateful.
Yeah.
I know how fortunate I am to have my family. And my Sangha is another family.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for.
Yeah. You're fortunate that you're a part of it. The move is going okay?
Yes.
Yeah, we're looking forward to having a retreat over there at Trout House in the fall.
That will be fun,
yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. I really enjoyed the Sila. It feels like common sense.
Mm.
So I feel I am on some level of integration, of understanding. The integration of the three. My practice is going well. Every day I have an opportunity to sharpen it against a stone, if you will. And and I'm finding I'm much more present to do that. To recognize that I'm either headed into something, like that's a wonderful thing when you can be proactive and understand you're headed toward something that might take you off the path or distract you, and instead you can prepare for it, and it almost passes like a storm that doesn't affect you, that you might have been engaged in it. So I see that happening more and more that each day as I work with many people, many situations, that I'm able to navigate them better by thinking of the refuge of all of this. And then certainly in my personal life as well, as things come up, in my relationship or in how I'm doing with my children, there's just a steadier or if there is any return to old hindrances or mental fabrications, it's very short-lived. And then you can take a moment to recognize what has just passed, which historically would not have, and what has just passed, and that's a really nice development and a nice moment to just acknowledge, I didn't do this, or this didn't happen, or whatever it is, which just reinforces why you want to continue down this path and why it's, why it's effective, why it's absolutely effective. If you're doing the things you need to do, right after your meditation, reading if you can, coming here, being with people, right, being with the sun, very effective. Even though today, on some level, feels like it should be Friday, it's actually been two very good days where I've dealt with certain things head on and was effective and disenchanted, versus how I might have handled some of these things in the past. So it's just been very busy, couple of days, but great. Just really good to sit and think about it right now, that what is absent is wonderful. So,
thank you. Wow, that'd be great. Being mindful of what's not there is as important, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Jen, good to see you tonight.
When I first started practicing, this is the kind of the teaching that would have taken to me that I just would have taken it more harshly than is skillful, and that I would have, tried to tell myself that now I have to change everything in my life so that I'm never around people who are not, sitting the Dhamma. And something that Lorna said kind of reminded me of that. And then, but I also recall something that you said, and I can't remember what it was, in this teaching that sort of points you to, that's not what it's saying. It's saying that the Sangha is important, but it's unrealistic to say you can't be around other people who are not studying the Dhamma. That's just not...
Yeah.
That's just that way of thinking is just more ignorance.
Yeah, it is.
And so then the middle way kind of comes back to me. This time hearing a teaching like this, it was more of a kind of a middle way that I was hearing it from, more of a middle way of being able to say here that it was saying that the Sangha is extremely important, and that you want to cultivate your relationships in the Sangha so that you can cultivate relationships with that wisdom outside the Sangha. At least that's what I heard.
You heard correctly. That's really what the Buddha... Hey, think about the lives of the original Sangha. They didn't spend their entire life isolated from the world. In fact, it was really just the opposite. They were engaged in the world on a daily basis, almost daily basis. During the rainy season, they might have spent more time away from the world. That was just out of practicality. Every day they got up off their cushion and walked into town with their alms bowl. They interacted with the town. They gave them a little bit of teaching. Many of them then, once they understood the Dhamma well enough, the Buddha sent them out to teach the whole countryside. So they were, in effect, they went to work every day too. And they engaged in the world. But the teaching is about admirable friends within the Dhamma, kalyanamitas, being true friends in the Dhamma. It means to be focused on the Dhamma. And then, like you said, then you take it off your cushion, out of the community and out into the world. And in some ways, you're going to have a very powerful benefit, won't you? Whether it's directly or not, just by your mindful presence. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, too. Thank you for tonight's teachings.
You're welcome. Glad you're here.
Mm-hmm.
There was an announcement. What is it? Oh, we are not going to do a work day for Rare and Learning Cooperative. What we've decided, input from Mary Beth and Scott and Matt, they need a road sign out front, hopefully to generate a little bit more interest. And Matt knows a fellow in, I'm not sure, Lambertville, I think. He's the guy that made our sign, by the way. And he gave us a price, and so instead of doing a work day, we're going to have a donation box set out and take some donations to help pay for the sign. So I'll get that out next week, and that'll be our Dhamma project for the Rare and Learning Cooperative. But again, if any of you are interested in teaching there at all, and it could be anything that you're interested in, they're always open to have somebody come in, even if it's a one-time deal, just to talk to the kids about something you're interested in. You can always talk to me about it or get a hold of Mary Beth. And I think that's it. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness unite your mind and your body. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.